kind of a lie. I just thought of it right now.
But the best analogy is like the ending of Thelma and Louise. That's what it's like to start a podcast with me, because it's like you just hold hands and drive off the cliff and see where it lands. Just because, what's the point of planning? You were like, do you have any questions for me? I'm like, yeah, I'll give them to you when we're there.
You're such a prick.
No, with this episode too, this episode's kind of easy formally, because it's like a close reading episode. And it's also because of what we're reading, it's going to be a kind of, it's interesting for me to pick your editorial brain, because I secretly love this stuff. It's a translation of On Zionist Literature by Hassan Kanafani, the famous Palestinian writer, intellectual, hero, icon, martyr, revolutionary. So we're here today to talk about that. Louis, welcome back to the show. Guests who don't know you, for people who don't know you, you've been on the show before. Can you introduce yourself? You're a friend of the podcast.
I am a friend of the podcast, I suppose, yeah. I guess the most salient reason I'm here today is because I run a website called Liberated Texts, which is a book review website, but not for new books, for books that in one way or another have been neglected or overlooked or underappreciated generally in some way. And that includes books that have not been translated into English for one reason or another. And as part of that, and I can maybe talk about this a little bit more in a second, but as part of that, and it was always my intention to do so beyond reviewing, I've kind of moved into publishing / republishing / translating. And the first successful project, or the first project that we've done on that, was the first ever English translation of Hassan Kanafani's, like you said, On Zionist Literature, which we published on July 8th, which is now almost 2 months ago, which was the 50th anniversary of Kanafani's killing by Israel.
Yes, congratulations, Louis. This is a fantastic book. Congratulations on the website. Congratulations. I mean, I think you've been on the show since the website launched, I think. And you've hosted a few things, a few episodes. So people who are listening to the show for a while will know.
Yeah, we did an episode pretty much about Liberated Texts, where you slated books.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, actually, now I'm here to eat my own words. To eat my own delicious words, because this is a monumental task. I've been reading this for the last couple of days, and the amount of work that went into this book, and like just love and obsession and sweat and tears, and I can't even imagine the stress of doing this, because you know there's a lot here, and I imagine that it was quite the slog to obviously work on the translation, but also like find the sources, do the editorial work. So I want to dive into to the work. I mean, this is the text. I guess we can get into the actual argument of the text, but unfortunately, I'm a pedant and I'm interested in the production first.
Yeah, of
because
course.
It's I can see that it's like I've translated a few things, and the pain of even just one like introduction to a book by a translator, like the translator's preface. Translating that took me like a year, and then like the archaeology of the whole publication, which is kind of what you have to do, and to like dig up every square inch of it, took another long time. So I just looked at this and I was like, my God, this is quite the work. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Maybe explain to us the motivation, the background, just kind of tell us the background of this.
I mean, yeah, I just based on what you just said, I mean, it was very difficult, and I think I probably underestimated the extent to which it would be a challenge in more ways than one. In some ways, that's made it very well. In many ways, that's made it very rewarding, and I'm very pleased that we did it. But in hindsight, it was maybe not the ideal book for this to be the first one to do, because it did present many challenges. And it wouldn't have been possible without me and the translator Mahmoud working not only together very closely, but kind of, I mean, there was a period for a couple of weeks where we were both working until like midnight and just furiously sending backwards and forwards.
I remember. You were very stressed during that time.
Yeah, it was tough.
It's like, poor Louis, he's going through it.
But yeah, I mean, we can talk about maybe the ins and outs of the actual process more in a little bit, but just in terms of, you know, how and why this came about. So yeah, it grew out of Liberated Text. Actually, where even before the website existed, being aware that Canifani's nonfiction had barely been translated into English was kind of quite at the forefront of my mind. Because like I say, although Liberated Text began and still it was primarily reviews, I did have this intention to try and move it into translation and publishing. And basically that came about much, much quicker than I would have previously thought through this relationship that I formed with Ebb Magazine. And that kind of just fast-tracked it all because they'd been working on publishing as well. So we just kind of collaborated and are continuing to collaborate in a really great way. And so one reason in particular that the fact that Canifani's nonfiction hadn't been translated into English was in my mind was because, for very obvious reasons, there is a very significant Palestinian diaspora in the West that in many cases, although they're very politically aware and often engaged and informed, their Arabic reading ability is not fantastic. And, you know, there's a host of reasons for that, including the fact that obviously there is a substantial difference between spoken and written Arabic. And, I'm very sympathetic to that. And a whole lot of those Palestinians in the West, and I think Arabs in the West generally, will know of Canifani, respect him in many ways, but they're blocked from accessing his more overtly political work, which is extensive. And, you know, I should clarify, and we can talk about this as well, like none of this is me saying that his fiction is unimportant in any way. On the contrary, but I think it's quite striking that with aside from his relatively short study of the Great Revolt between 1936 and 1939, virtually nothing else that he wrote that is not fiction has been translated into English. When I first realized it, and when I first realized the extent to which he has written nonfiction, I was very surprised. And so obviously there's a lot of nonfiction by him. So why choose on Zionist literature? I mean, on a very basic level, you have to start somewhere, and no one person or organization can realistically do it all. But I was particularly struck by on Zionist literature for a number of reasons. And I guess they relate both to the content of the book itself, but also the context of the book. In terms of the content, I mean, to some extent, it was quite a almost instinctive thing. When I first read the book, which, to be completely honest, I can't remember exactly when it was. I think it was about 2 years ago, maybe a little bit less. I'd had it for a while, but had actually got around to reading it. And then I read it. And from the moment I read the intro, I was just really struck by it. And the intro, Canifani's introduction, I mean. So what he does towards the end of the introduction, he says, you know, I reference multiple things throughout this study, paraphrasing, but, you know, that make a host of inaccurate, ahistorical, offensive, absurd, etc. claims about Palestinians, about Arabs. But I don't really bother to kind of refute them in any detail, because it's taken for granted that, you know, basically my audience or the audience know that these things are not true. And in fact, the only reason I'm looking and analyzing these works is on the basis or on the principle of know your enemy. And that's the literally those are the final words of the introduction, know your enemy. And I almost kind of got goosebumps when I read that for the first time. Not only because obviously that enemy killed him 5 years later, but because there was something extremely compelling realizing this study was a Palestinian revolutionary seeking to trace the genealogy of Zionist ideology in literature, you know, not from, you know, scholarly curiosity or because it would be good for his career to write a study like this and put it out there, but in a really, you can feel the almost, he's like furiously trying to figure out, where has this come from? How has this happened? And
it's tactical literary criticism.
Yeah. And you know, and so then there's, so that's the content. And obviously we can speak more about the content. The content combined with the context which within which I know he was writing and when it was published and how it was published, also spoke to me. Because so essentially it was published shortly after or during the same year as the Six-Day War in 1967. So Canifani is writing in not only kind of a revolutionary and very tumultuous period, both personally for himself and other Palestinians, but just politically generally, but it's also a moment of defeat, essentially.
It's called the Nexa.
The Nexa,
right?
Yeah. Like, which is usually translated as like a setback, or but it's worse than a setback. And obviously it's kind of calling it that, it's kind of referencing the Nakba as well, as in this is another thing. And, you know, it's just under 20 years later. But not only is it a time of defeat, and also a time in which the Arab nationalist ideology to which him, George Habash, and others had subscribed to up to that point. Because an important thing to remember about the context and the timing is that the PFLP hasn't been formed yet. It's actually formed very shortly after the publication of this book. So I think this book was also, it comes at a kind of transitory period in Ghassan's ideology and thinking. But yeah, so it's not only a time of defeat, but it's a time at which the Zionist control of the narrative, especially in the West, is so absolute that even in defeat, even when they're already refugees, the Palestinians are in many quarters, even supposedly leftist progressive quarters, are not considered kind of worthy or victims or a cause that should be supported. And on the contrary, the Zionist narrative, or Zionist kind of tropes and talking points, which he traces the genealogy of in this book, have been so completely accepted by many quarters in the West that, you know, as I'm sure you know, around this time, before and after, going to work on a kibbutz was considered, you know, a kind of leftist, progressive, you know, even socialist thing to do by many people. And if you kind of stop and zoom out for a second and think about that, that's an incredibly successful propaganda campaign that you have people, I would, you know, primarily, I guess, Europeans and North Americans directly partaking in settler colonialism, because that was, you know, one of the main reasons for the kibbutz system was to take more and more Palestinian land. They're directly partaking in that land theft, basically, but they're perceiving it as a progressive. So, you know, there's a whole host of things, but that, you know, that he's writing in that context. Not only have they been defeated, not only has Arab nationalism taken a real hit in terms of popularity and legitimacy and standing, but Israel is successfully portraying itself as, you know, the plucky little kid in the neighborhood, surrounded by the multiple evil Arab states that want to obliterate it. I mean, I'm assuming most people listening to this would know, but obviously the Six-Day War or the June War was unfortunately a huge success for Israel. But as I'm saying, not only kind of militarily, politically, territorially, but also in terms of the propaganda narrative. So he's writing in this context. Sorry, go on.
It's another way of saying that, like, Zionism is reaching a kind of, we could say, apex, at least effectively, in terms of its political, in terms of its own political project of establishing this settler colonial homeland in historic Palestine. Like, this is, if that is the goal, if that's like the objective goal, then 67 obviously represents one of the high points. This is the political nadir. I always get that wrong. Is it nadir the high one? Yes. Nadir or apex?
You mean the zenith. You mean the zenith, I think.
Zenith. The zenith. Nadir is the low point.
Nadir is the low point. Yeah. That was your nadir.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my nadir. And that was also their nadir. He's writing from the nadir in the sense. If the Nakba is the sort of continuation of the calamity, like a further falling behind after the calamity, then in the sense it is kind of the nadir, and he kind of lived in that time. And so it's interesting that this piece of work, and it's a study in a real sense, is that as you read it, that it's a man trying to really grapple with an ideological force and like a linguistic cultural force that has been kind of imposed upon him. And it made me something, as I was reading, I realized is like, you know, all my views of Zionism or like sort of philosophical, sort of theoretical perspectives on it are all almost uniquely Jewish, are all Jewish, either pro or anti-Zionist writers, right? Those are the people. And I've read very few critiques of Palestinian Zion. I mean, there is Edward Said's famous essay, Zionism from the Standpoint of Its Victims. And that's probably like the only one I've read. And I realize now that, wow, like I should have been thinking about Zionism through Palestinian voices this whole time, instead of the way I do it, which is my own Western training, which is to see it as a subset, as one of the sort of, let's say, branches of the genocidal tree of British settler colonialism. And like, and always kind of like, I tend to historicize it because that's generally been my view, whereas this is a kind of reading of Zionism from below, so to speak, of its first occupants, or like this, of its first guinea pigs, text, the people who saw it up close and personal. Let me put it that way.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that's, I mean, maybe it was kind of implicit in what I was saying, but that's obviously another one of the compelling things about this book, is that it's so rare to be reading analysis of Zionism broadly defined by a Palestinian voice. And, you know, like you say, it's grappling is a very good word that you used, because you can almost feel that from the text. He's really trying to understand, and not just for the purpose of, you know, like I said, kind of intellectual curiosity or career ambition, or it's because he wants to understand his enemies, and he wants to understand how not only have they won militarily and politically, but in many quarters, they have dominated the narrative to such an extent that participating in the ongoing dispossession of the Palestinians in their land has been successfully deemed to be a progressive, positive thing. And the Arabs representing just, you know, medievalism, backwardness. And, you know, that's a theme that he picks out in a lot of, especially the kind of post-48 novels. Which all use, as he says, almost kind of identical tropes. And, you know, that's one of his arguments. By the kind of 50s, the Zionist novel has kind of really become like kind of set in stone, and they use just almost really formulaic, the same tropes again and again and again. And, you know, that's one of his arguments, is like, by this point, this is not art in any meaningful way whatsoever. This is just political propaganda serving a purpose. Just another thing about the context of the book that I think is also worth noting, and was of interest to me specifically because it relates to a kind of another interest of mine, which is the Palestine Research Center. The Palestine Research Center was the PLO's research center. Established in Beirut in 1965. So this was only published 2 years after its establishment, and it was commissioned and published by the PRC. And the PRC is that kind of underappreciated, but until it was destroyed by Israel following the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, published an incredible range of books, pamphlets, and other publications, not only in English and Arabic, but in many, many other languages, and produced extremely rigorous and effective propaganda, basically. I use propaganda there not as a value judgment, just as a kind of neutral term, because that's, you know, that's what it was. It was intended to raise awareness and support for the Palestinian cause. It was still rigorous in its and, you know, objective, but it had a purpose, and it was very effective. And, you know, that's something that was understood by Israel, obviously, because during the invasion of Lebanon in 1982, and it was as part of a broader onslaught against the cultural and intellectual and educational networks that the PLO and the Palestinians generally had established in Lebanon by that point, which were extensive and in many ways more advanced than the Lebanese state's own networks. They were largely hunted down and destroyed, and the PRC is a good example of that, because not only was it bombed and many people killed, but the Israelis wholesale took the archive and all the publications of it. And I guess the point that I wanted to make about that is it shows the importance of institutional support. And that's something that obviously in many ways has been destroyed and degraded in the time since then. Intentionally, there are many reasons why, but you know, foremost amongst them, Israel's intentional destruction of these institutions and of these networks. And so in the new translation, we've included the initial, which is very short, but the initial preface, which is by the then director of the PRC, Anis Sayegh, who was another very important Palestinian intellectual. And really, for the duration of it, the PRC's existence, a kind of almost basically who's who of prominent and important Palestinian intellectuals and artists and others worked for or collaborated with the center in some way. So what happened in 1982 was a big loss.
Yeah, I mean, there's to get back, you know, there is a kind of project on the one hand on Zionism, which is exterminate all the brutes. That's the sort of colonial signature that all empires have when it comes to their colonial subjects, and it's not something that's unique to the Zionist sort of project of colonizing Palestine. Like, that's, you know, like, there are stories, like horror stories of here where I live, you know, more than enough. And the identity itself of the indigenous person is such a threat. Their language has to be banned. Their culture has to be destroyed. I mean, they erected entire schools, a whole institutional artifice to manufacture, you know, British colonial subjects or sort of Canadian colonial subjects inside of these, let's say, indigenous bodies, because that was the whole project. It was kill the Indian, save the man. And that idea of erasing identity, and yeah, it's not unique to the Zionists. It's just interesting that Palestinians have managed not only to like retain their own sense of selfhood, their own land, their own, you know, their own sense of like their connection to the land, which is to say their language, their culture, their identity, you know, their food, whatever, but they've also had the ability to close read their enemy and their nemesis in the form of this essay. So I think that, sure, like, I mean, you're right in the sense that like these are institutional losses that happen all the time, right? Like, just one example is the destruction of the PRC. But it also speaks to the historic and profound and ultimately like very telling insecurity on the part of the Zionists that they need to stamp out any potential flame of Palestinian identity so brutally. And like, you know, they martyred this guy, Ghassan Kanafani, sure, but like his words live on, his ideas live on. The PFLP is still around. This is not a project that's just simply going away. And so the memory of that loss and the memory of those martyrs, you know, obviously plays a role in the continuing legacy of Palestinian resistance. So I don't know, there's kind of two ways to read it, I think. And yeah, like there is a danger in, I think it speaks more to like the dangerous and ultimately like the, you know, you have the tactical sort of, you know, question about like, okay, do we consolidate all of our things into one place like other countries do? Or do we kind of, and make ourselves therefore vulnerable to the kinds of things like happened that got assembled in, you know, Beirut in 1982, right? And so the PLO made this very strong state, and like the Zionists like, okay, you want to make one there? Like, you know, I don't say state within a state. I think that's wrong. I think it's like a phalangist thing. But ultimately, yes, the PLO had a very strong institutional power in Beirut in the 70s and the 80s. And yes,
beyond Beirut as well. I mean, it was...
Yeah, beyond Beirut, I guess that's true too. And so that became... You attract the forces, because if anytime you like gather in large numbers, either figuratively or literally, like that makes that a target to your enemy, right? Your enemy knows you and what you're doing. So ultimately, like the emergence of Palestinian resistance and this, let's say, more like, what's the word I want to look for? Like there are cells. It's like cellular now. It seems that Palestinian resistance is more cellular as opposed to the days of the PLO, where there were these large resistance organizations that tried to behave like states. I guess this is more of a comment on like the evolution of Palestinian resistance and less on the book. So maybe we should get back into the book. maybe we can kind of outline, you probably know this book better than anyone, almost, because they say that translation is the closest form of reading. Editorial work is a very close form of translation, I think, because you're actually translating, you're translating a kind of the sentences onto the publication and kind of translating forms of the draft into the final production. So I think that's interesting that in your position, you got to see the translation, the literal translation from Arabic to English happen, but you also transpose that translation into a physical document, because you have to, like, there are publishing needs. There are, like, your the printer needs this and that, and, like, they do it this way, and, like, you have to kind of, that itself is its own language, which is interesting. So you probably know this book very, very well. You probably know it inside and out. Can you lay out the basic core of the argument?
Just before I talk about the book itself, I just wanted to say, on the things we were discussing to do with the PLO and kind of institutional power and state within a state, or whatever you want to refer to it as, I'm currently reading a very good book about that. It's called The Palestinian Liberation Organization, People, Power and Politics, and it's by Helena Cobben. It's old. It's from, I think, the 80s. And the author was a correspondent herself in Beirut from, like, the late 70s to the early 80s. So a lot of it is based on her reporting and or interviews with the relevant people involved. So it's a very good book that I happen to be reading right now. So, yeah, in terms of the book, I mean, I did get to know it very, very intimately. And actually, one of the things that struck me when I first read it, knowing the context, both personally and politically, in which it was written by Hassan, I remember thinking, how did he write this? Like, I mean, as in, like, literally, when did he do this? He had about 3 journalistic jobs. He was, you know, politically involved and engaged in many ways, not to mention having a family, not to mention being a stateless person in Lebanon, occasionally having to go into hiding, and, you know, a far, far from a stable existence kind of conducive to such a study and such a book. And I think it's mentioned, she either told me herself or it's actually mentioned, I think it's mentioned in her preface, Annie Kanafani, his widow, who I do want to talk about specifically at some point as well. She basically said he did it after his day job, after other things, sometimes on the weekends or working into the evening and at night, which was at some point when, especially that particularly stressful period when I was doing exactly the same thing, reading exactly the same things, it was quite interesting because I really felt like I was, you know, retracing his steps, reading the same things, getting angry over the same things, getting outraged by the same quotes and extracts. And because one thing which is, you know, people probably have assumed, but to say explicitly, as part of the translation and editorial process, me and Mahmoud, the translator, had to find the originals of everything that he quotes. And I think that's probably one of the things that I underestimated the most, both in terms of not only how difficult that would be in some cases, but just how time consuming. But it's extremely important, I think, not only for mine and Mahmoud's ability to fully understand his argument and the book, but also because as much as possible, we wanted to avoid publishing a translation of his translation of something. Because obviously, going through 2 translation cycles like that, you can really completely lose meaning in some cases. You know, some cases, it doesn't really change anything. It's simple enough. But, you know, nuance can very easily be lost. At worst, meaning can completely be changed. And there were a few instances where, prior to us finding the original, Mahmoud had translated a translation of Ghassan's, and it had just... We were kind of laughing when we realized what something had actually said, because it was, like, completely different. So that was very time consuming and difficult.
Hey man, they can't all be home runs. You gotta strike out sometimes.
I mean, and also one thing I should say, you know, certainly not to cast aspersions on Hassan himself in any way, but it was quite a rough book. It was clearly not really edited, not particularly proofread. I think that probably partly speaks to the somewhat chaotic revolutionary period in which it was produced. But having spoken to a friend of mine who knows a lot about the history of Arabic publishing, I think it was also just quite typical of the time that there wasn't much editing, basically. Someone just would write a book and then it would be it would be published, or printed rather. And so that definitely complicated things as well, because it's quite a rough, it was quite a rough document in Arabic. And it's also because of the nature of the topic and the number of kind of different things that are discussed, it's not an easy text. I think even now, still the English, it's not necessarily an easy text. And I think, as Steve Salaita mentioned,
he would have to get people to bring him books.
Well, yeah.
Because a lot of the books he couldn't.
Yeah, so that's the other thing that came to my mind when I was reading the Arabic for the first time, is not only, you know, kind of how did he do this time-wise, it was also how the hell did he get all these various sources? And I think especially for the later period where he's looking at kind of novels published not that long before that he's writing. Yeah, so again, it's mentioned in Annie's new preface for the translation. Foreign friends would bring him things at his request. So I think the earlier part of the book, which is about an old, you know, the older historical period, I think some of that study was done during his time at the University of Damascus, where he did study comparative or English literature of some kind, I think. And that's when he met George Habash as well. But then the later period was written, I mean, especially the last chapter, it's clearly written after the Six-Day War. But so, yeah, in terms, so that's more kind of, that's more context still. The book itself, like I say, it's not actually an easy book, and it takes for granted quite a lot of knowledge in some ways on behalf of the reader. But it is essentially, like I said, him trying to trace the genealogy of Zionist ideology through the medium of literature. And one of his kind of big arguments or central arguments is essentially that what he refers to as political Zionism, i.e. Zionism that has taken on kind of recognizable, organized political shape, usually, you know, dated post the Baal Conference in 1897. He argues that a lot of this Zionist ideology and Zionist tropes formed before political Zionism had taken shape, and it was formed in the medium of literature. But he not only goes back to Victorian novels, which obviously you're well versed in. He doesn't only go back that far. He goes back very far within kind of Jewish history, and he opens essentially with the role of Hebrew and kind of the linguistic element of Zionism. So there's a whole chapter, for example, looking at the development of the myth of the wandering Jew and how that came to change over time through Zionist influence. He talks, and he then eventually transitions and ends with, like I've mentioned previously, these post-48 novels that essentially seek to justify the Nakba and begin to do so by the 50s, 60s in a very formulaic way that you can almost tick, oh yeah, this trope, this trope, this trope, this trope. And then the final chapter is specifically about the 1966 Nobel Prize for Literature, which went to an Israeli author called Agnon. And that's where he kind of makes the argument that the Nobel Committee's decision to award him that was absolutely nothing to do with literature or with art. It was part of, and in some ways contributed to the support that Israel received during the Six-Day War, and was part of a broader propaganda campaign and narrative. And he refers to, throughout the book, he refers to what he's analysing as a colossal scheme. And one thing, you know, which to some people's ears might sound, you know, slightly hyperbolic or kind of over the top in some way. But in doing the process that me and Mahmoud did, which I mentioned, you know, locating all these sources, that obviously required quite a lot of supplementary research in different ways. And in doing that, me and Mahmoud located information that, for one reason or another, I think in some cases because it just wasn't available at the time, others because he just decided not to include it for some reason to keep the book concise. But we found information that massively vindicates Ghassan's argument. like I say, I think a lot of it because it just he just couldn't have known that at the time, or it's things that he mentions but doesn't elaborate on. Because that's the thing, given the enormous breadth of kind of history and themes that he talks about, it's a short book, or relatively short book. And I think one criticism could be made that there are times that a little bit of elaboration or further extrapolation of an argument would be very useful, but he occasionally kind of leaves you hanging a little bit.
But that's just us. That's just our own training of, like, be exhaustive, write 400-page books. Like, whatever, man, get the job done. You figure it out. Like, you get the argument already. You don't need to keep going. Like, there's a scholarly output for us has so much to do with keeping the ivory tower, like, workers, you know, as busy as possible and manufacturing as much as possible, right? Like, publish or perish or whatever. But, like, so that's why I guess in some ways, like, this, the ideas about how to write criticism and how to publish and all these things, these are things that we have ingrained in us because we're students of the West, right? But, like, you're a Palestinian journalist, you're a writer, you're a father, your dad, you're just gonna, like, do your business, and you're, again, it's like a tactical study. It's not intended for...
No, yeah, you know, exactly. Like,
it's not intended for the annals of, for the scholarly types, because obviously, because he's a man who's obsessed, who's thinking about praxis. In a
sense. Yeah. There's
a great line on page 9. This is the kind of, like, I think it's kind of part of the argument of the book, or at least especially the first half, or maybe the whole book, actually. It was ineluctable for Zionism as a fabricated political movement to weaponize language with such vehemence, an effort only matched by its hostility to social integration against which it presented itself as an alternative. Which is to say that Zionism in the context of the 19th century, and that's where some of the early parts of the book begin, in the 19th century British imagination specifically, and I guess French too, German too, actually, what am I saying? My thesis advisor, Amir Mufti, would love this book, I'm sure. Maybe he's already found it. Maybe he's already cited it somewhere, because he wrote a book on the Jewish question in the history of Europe, and, you know, that, and how this Zionism was an answer to the Jewish question. I mean, that's kind of a general proposal of Zionism, is that we don't need to integrate here. We can make our own homeland somewhere else. We don't belong here. These people will never accept us, which is hilarious, because if you think about it on its face, is that Zionism is an anti-Semitic worldview that views Jews as like not belonging to the rest of the world, yeah, but only
exactly.
belonging.
I'm
going to keep going with this quote because it's a great quote. Weaponizing language in this way sharpened the contradiction within the Zionist cause, which wants to amalgamate nationalism with religion into a single concept. The work of the Nobel Prize winner Agnon, for example, cannot be comprehended by an international audience because it features a complex melange of religious rituals on the one hand and political project on the other, right? And so this book reminded me, and this kind of reading reminded me of the kind of audacity of Zionism, which is take this group of people who don't share a common language, right, and manufacture them as a national nation state project. And the basis of a nation state project almost always is this national language, right? Like, we know, like, you know, we know from Benedict Anderson, you have to imagine a community, but you also have to stitch it together in its social life, and you need a language to kind of grease the rails. And in doing that, I mean, to this day, Hebrew, in like that 2011 study I sent you, like, it's spoken as a native language by only 49% of people in Israel. Now, that's its own. There's a funny thing inside of that, which is a huge chunk of their population is indigenous Arabic speakers, which they like to call, you know, Israeli Arabs, which is just more racism because it races them. But the other huge part of that, and that's a way of saying, is that the question of Russian and Ukrainian Zionism is a huge important role has in the Zionist project in terms of recruitment of settlers. I remember there was like a thing about Trump Heights. They built this place called Trump Heights.
Yeah, I remember the picture, yeah.
And there was no, like, they were all Russian speakers. Like, they didn't know any Hebrew. Like, there's a ton of people in Israel who are part of the Zionist project who have nothing to do, who want nothing to do with the national project of Hebrew, which kind of tells you something about the state of what this movement has both accomplished historically, which has been a lot, right? But also of its aging future. Because you, like, I don't know, I guess you could say the same things, like, oh, lots of places that are settler colonial in origin have people who don't speak its mother tongue. However, I don't think 49%, I don't think the number is 49% anywhere. English is a pretty dominant language, and the fact that you can't really compare that. I don't know. There's a lot. There's a lot there in that.
Can I just go back to something you said at the beginning, which is Kanafani is very clear and does not shy away from the fact that Zionism, as it, you know, as this Zionist ideology, which he's tracing the genealogy of, was emerging and solidifying, they viewed social integration as a threat, and it was. There were and key kind of publications and key novels and key things that he talks about happened at moments when it was looking like social integration was becoming more possible.
You mean social integration of Jews in Europe?
Yeah, specifically. Yeah, sorry. I'm doing what Hassan does and taking for granted that people know what you're talking about. And so that's one thing that he does very well, which I think is very important, which is as a threat to both elite Jewish circles, but also more broadly, Zionism being used as a means to push back and fight against Jewish communists, and as being part of class struggle within Europe during that period. Again, that's something that which I feel like could be elaborated on, but you know, maybe that's beyond the confines of that book. But it's certainly a theme throughout what he's talking about, and the inability to, you can't separate culture and literature from imperialism, basically imperialism and or Zionism. The point about Hebrew. Again, we can maybe talk about this more in a bit, but I was in Beirut a few weeks ago, and I was lucky enough to meet with Annie Kanafani, Ghassan's widow, and Leila Kanafani, who his daughter, who they're both amazing, and we had a really wonderful, several hours long, wide-ranging talk about a number of things. But Leila told me something that I had never actually heard explicitly, but kind of had wondered about and kind of assumed maybe on some level, but I'm sure you've probably noticed, like, Israeli Hebrew speakers, when they say Hamas, they say Hamas. When they say Hezbollah, they say Hezbollah, Hamas. And the reason for that is when these waves of settlers were arriving in Palestine, primarily European, they couldn't say ha, which is a letter in Hebrew as well. So they just changed the pronunciation of, I mean, I guess that's one of the advantages of when you're using a language in this way, you can actually just make changes. They changed the pronunciation in Hebrew of all ha to ch, because they just couldn't say it, and they still can't say it in many cases. And she told me this this very telling and almost kind of comical irony that Palestinians, when they speak Hebrew, can say the ha, and I think do use the ha, but when Israelis themselves are speaking Hebrew, everything is ha ha ha, which, you know, as you studied Arabic, you know, ha is not actually used that much in Arabic, but for some reason to the foreign ear, ha is largely heard as ha, and it's for that reason they say Hamas, Hezbollah, etc., which I think, you know, it's quite amusing, but it's also extremely telling that these are Europeans who not only didn't speak Hebrew, literally cannot say the required noises to speak Hebrew in the way that it previously was. So they just changed it to make Europeans able to say the noises required. And then you have the Palestinians, the supposed alien Palestinians, who can actually pronounce the letter. It's a very telling vignette, I think.
The list of books that he kind of makes his way through a series of texts to kind of unfold a question for himself, which is, I feel like he's asking, like, how did this, like, very contradictory project of political Zionism, right, which combined all these things that didn't go together, never before had, you know, like, English, like, middle-class London, like, people from middle-class Londoners of Jewish descent, and, like, peasants from, like, Ukraine, like, come together and share a life together on a place like a kibbutz, right? Which is something that happened in life, Like, it's a contradictory force in the sense that there are all these social forces that go against that, that cohere against that. So you need something to imagine yourself. Now, we, like, you know, the history, the Benedict Anderson thing of imagining communities, like, it's interesting to me that, you know, this is one of the most, like, telling, very illuminating sort of case studies of the imagined of the imagined community, right, of nationalism, which is to say Zionism, because that nationality is 100% purely political, right? There's no that, and that the linguistic element of Hebrew is what stitches together a series of very different identities, right? Which is, you know, I told this story on Twitter once. I had like a nemesis in my undergrad, like a Zionist nemesis. And by the end of undergrad, we had this kind of begrudging tolerance for each other just because of like, it'd been 4 years of arguing with each other and we just kind of knew each other. And it turns out, like, I learned a little bit about, he was an Iraqi, son of Iraqi Jews, and big, very sort of like ardent Zionist, very proud Zionist. He sends me an email on the last day of camp, like one of, towards the end of the camp, towards the end of school, like in our fourth year, we were in the same year. And he says, oh, I want you to know that you've helped inspire me to go to Israel and join the IDF. And I never responded.
What the
and, yeah. Yeah. Well, whatever. He was an interesting guy. But anyways, the end of the story is I Googled him like a year ago. He's like a stock bro in New York. Like it meant, Zionism meant so much to you that you couldn't even go live there full time. That it's like the place that you go and it's the place where you build a cottage. Right. And that was a kind of, it was an interesting story, is that like, yeah, there are a lot of things about Israel that the most ardent Zionists probably don't want to be a part of. Right. Like, for instance, the skin cancer rates is that, like, oh, all these white people showing up to this Mediterranean climate who like don't have the protection, the natural protection like that of that, like being indigenous gives you, which is like, oh, your skin, your whatever has been primed for this kind of weather, has been attenuated.
Well, right? which speaks to the same thing about the
the foreignness of Zionism and its ability to turn that foreignness on the basis of a and using Hebrew, which was largely a liturgical language, language.
And kind of funny, you know, he makes that argument in the first chapter very, very clearly and kind of evidenced. There was something I wanted to say earlier that we got distracted. I mean, there are so many, we could have an entirely different conversation about this book, over an hour. You know, there are so many different things that could be discussed. But one thing which I mentioned but then didn't finish talking about was some of these kind of facts that we uncovered through the research of finding the sources, which really vindicate Kanafani's argument and his notion that, you know, this was a colossal scheme, quote unquote. I mean, there are many, and I can just talk about a few, and all of them are included in the book itself, in the translator notes. So hopefully we've enriched the book to some extent. But so, for example, one of the, possibly the book that he speaks about, or rather, critiques the most, or one of the most, is a book that was came out in 1958 by an American author called Leon Uris, and it's called Exodus. It's still now a pretty well-known book, and in many ways
it's a famous airport book. You can always find in the kind of airport bookshop, schlock fiction.
So Kanafani alludes to its prominence. Well, more than alludes, he makes it clear that this was a very successful, widely read book. But I think upon my first reading, I hadn't quite realized how huge it was. It was almost immediately translated into dozens and dozens and dozens of languages. I think within 2 years, it was made into a big budget Hollywood film starring Paul Newman, you know, at the time, a huge star. It was the first, just a little bizarrely interesting thing, it was the first film that Dalton Trumbo, who was previously blacklisted as part of the McCarthy hearings, it was his first post-McCarthy or post-blacklisting screenwriter role.
Basically, those American communists, and their solidarity.
Well, yeah. But I mean, point being, and you know, he doesn't mention this in the book, he may have been aware that the film had come out, but. And also, it was on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks, months, I think years even. Like, it sold something like 5 million copies. It was a literary kind of phenomenon. And it's written only 10 years after the Nakba, and it is just the crudest, most disgusting, most insulting, politically driven, basically, you know, post-the-fact justification for the Zionist colonization of Palestine and the Nakba specifically. And it went, and that book in particular established a lot of the tropes that were then used in other novels. For example, many of the tropes used in that were then used in another novel a few years later called Cast a Giant Shadow, which then again,
which was also a movie,
which was also made into a movie.
I think Martin Sheen. Or no,
no, father. It was no. It had Kirk Douglas, Frank Sinatra, Yul Brynner, John Wayne.
His name was Mickey, but he fought like David. This was Mickey Marcus. From the streets of New York.
It wasn't General Sherman who said war is hell, it was Mrs. Sherman.
To the Pentagon in Washington.
Don't involve the army in any way. Don't use your rank or even your right name.
Is it all right with you if I keep the same sex?
To the fields of West Point, to the beaches of Normandy, to the deserts of the Middle East. Everywhere he lived, and everywhere he fought, he cast a giant shadow. Kirk Douglas as Mickey Marcus. His courage changed millions of lives. His legend belongs to many flags.
I'm fighting because I'm stiff-necked and proud of it. Next week, Ash. Next week.
Senta Berger as Magda. For women in combat, love draws its own battle lines.
They wanted to run away, and now you run away just like me, coward! Coward, just
Magda!
Like me!
Oh!
I was the only girl in Brooklyn who didn't get pregnant during the war.
Hmm?
Well, yeah, my mother kept the statistics.
So again, this is like absolutely huge Hollywood blockbuster production. So, and, you know, and again, that was written just 1 year prior. Sorry, that film was released just 1 year prior to the book being published. He may or may not have been aware of that. But, you know, the more you look into these things that he's talking about, their importance and their prominence, you realize, wow, at the time, even if some of them have been forgotten, which many of them have, and which actually, again, vindicates his argument that much of this output was not art. You know, a lot of these things, people are not reading these things anymore. They served a direct political purpose at a specific time. Some of them still are read or remembered in some ways, but many aren't. Another thing, for example, so he quotes, he being Lassan, he quotes at length someone called John Kimshi. He quotes his review of Exodus, where he basically says, it's actually, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, it's basically a bad book, but it's brilliant for American Jews. And it's become more read than the Bible. It's basically become the book that people read to understand Israel, quote unquote. And he basically lauds it as successful propaganda, even if it's not a good book. Ghassan couldn't have known this. John Kimshi's brother, David Kimshi, who he already had and went on to write even more books with, became the deputy director of Mossad. And throughout the, I think, 60s, 70s, 80s, was the kind of notorious Israeli spy master kind of Mossad figure. So almost in every direction you look, you unturn little things, it more vindicates this notion that this is a colossal scheme. These things were not kind of, they just didn't happen by chance. Those films weren't made because they were just such good books. You know, there was a clear political program underway, which obviously has not stopped.
I mean, yeah, they release a ton of Zionist movies every year, and they're big name actors.
Well, and you know,
Fauda
on Netflix, oh, and, you know, like.
I mean, no, it's like the thing is that, like, there's Zionism, which is the colonial land project, which is, you know, guns and force and ethnic cleansing and rape and pillaging and murder and, you know, and all that. And then there's the branding of Zionism as this liberatory force of progression.
Progressive,
in the
world. Yeah.
Yeah. And thing is, we're millennials, right? So we had a certain kind of ideological, we lived in a certain ideological environment where power was kind of rebranded as, you know, like for you know, for the good. I mean, I guess there's always been that mission civilatrice stuff, but I think that there, and this is our perennial argument about the meaning of propaganda, and that there's, that this is the post facto application of a kind of sheen or an avatar over historical facts and over historical realities in the hopes of just making the actual, and keeping busy a class of people who are tasked with, you know, like shilling for whatever imperial task it is. So like the imagination of India, for instance, as this place, right? Like the same, not the same, but different, because it's a different time, but like the colonization of India required of the entire subcontinent, right? Required an immense sort of like enacting of imagination, right? And that's basically was Edward Said's post-Orientalism career of like, how did they imagine their power, right? Like, because Orientalists said too, like, know your enemy, right? Except they didn't say it out loud. Like, they didn't, but it was a project of knowing your enemy, and the enemy was the Oriental, right? So it's like it's an interesting thing. Keep going.
One thing, just a very interesting point of Kanafani's is that he is more, I mean, I wouldn't say positive, but he is less scathing about the output of some authors who are writing from basically from within Israel, or what, you know, what they call Israel, because he says basically those who write from afar, like Leon Uris and all these other mainly American authors, they weren't there, and they're able to be even more crude, even less nuanced, even more racist. So for example, he reviews the work of Ya'el Dayan, who's actually the daughter of Moshe Dayan, kind of relatively favorably compared to some of these, you know, for example, Leon Uris. But his basic argument is even those writers who maybe were there pre-48, maybe did have some Arab friends, etc., which he gives some examples. All of them, even those who supposedly offer a more nuanced position or less overtly racist, none of them can face what he calls the heart of the matter. And they're still constricted within the same Zionist framework, basically of lies and of justifying the unjustifiable. And he makes that point very, very profoundly. There's also another thing that I wanted to kind of make sure I spoke about a bit, which is the broader intention behind translating and publishing something non-fiction by Kanafani. And I think that's because by focusing, so a lot of people, for example, they maybe read Men in the Sun, they may be aware of his fiction, they'd kind of like and praise Kanafani in some way. They would take political positions very much at odds with the reality of Kanafani's own. And, you know, I'm not saying that you have to accept everyone's, the political ideology of someone to respect and like their writing. But I think there has been in some quarters a slightly defanging kind of liberal rewriting of Kanafani, which, you know, as we know, happens to most, if not all, dead revolutionaries in some way. And the reason I think that's important is because Kanafani himself, even prior to the formation of the PFLP, was extremely explicit in his support and overt belief in the importance of and moral worthiness of armed struggle. So, for example, in 1966, he visited Gaza. And when he came back, he wrote something which really struck me when I read it a couple of years ago. He said, "I now feel more than any time in the past that the sole value of my words is that they are a meager and insufficient substitute for the absence of weapons, and that they pale now before the emergence of real men who die every day in the pursuit of something that I respect." Now, I, and I'm sure many others, would probably agree he's being overly negative and downplaying the worth and importance of his words and of his own work. But the point is, he explicitly endorsed armed struggle. And actually, in a film,
that's why they killed him.
Of course, it's the combination of those things is, you know, it's one of the reasons they killed him. And in a film made a couple of years after that quote, after he visited Gaza, called, I think it's called Japanese Red Army World Revolution or something like that, which is this amazing film about the PFLP in Lebanon and about the Japanese Red Army members who went there. He's quoted in that film saying that armed struggle is the best form of propaganda. And he's the PFLP spokesperson by that point. So, of course, he's endorsing armed struggle. And so to take it back to the book, you know, the book is not actually about the legitimacy of armed struggle or otherwise, but it's more the point that I think by focusing solely, and obviously I'm talking about the Anglosphere here, if you focus solely on Hassan's nonfiction, I think that does a disservice to him and his principles, because we have to view his ideology, his principles, his work, his output, his life in its totality. And his writing, armed struggle, whatever we're talking about in relation to him or the Palestinian cause generally, I think all these things need to be viewed as constituent parts of a broader whole of resistance that includes armed struggle. And I think, unfortunately, elements of the kind of Palestine solidarity movement in the West have either lost sight of or maybe never even had sight of that. Because as I've written about before, you know, the endorsement of armed struggle is a disappointingly quite rare position, actually, in, you know, Western Palestine solidarity movements. Obviously, it does exist, but I think it should be just a complete given. And on that point on principles, I read something just a few weeks ago, which I found very moving and very relevant, because we've probably said it explicitly today, but we maybe haven't. Ghassan and his dear niece, Lamis, were both killed on July the 8th, 1972, killed by Mossad. And according to the account of Ghassan's sister, the day before they were both killed, Lamis had tried to convince him to kind of basically scale back his political work, his revolutionary activities, and concentrate on writing stories, i.e. fiction. And according to his sister, Ghassan responded, "Go back to writing stories. I write well because I believe in a cause, in principles. The day I leave these principles, my stories will become empty. If I were to leave behind my principles, you yourself would not respect me." And according to his sister's account, in doing so, he convinced Lamis that struggle and the defense of principles is what leads to success in all things. So not to make the same point again, but I think we have to consider Ghanafani in his totality, not just his nonfiction output. And again, as I said at the very beginning of this, this is not me saying that his nonfiction is unimportant. Sorry, his fiction is unimportant or less worthy than his nonfiction. On the contrary, they're as important as each other. And it's also not an endorsement of, you know, that 1966 quote where he's saying basically what I'm doing is pointless, it's only armed struggle. It's that all these things are important and all of them are part of resistance. And by translating on Zionist literature, which is a key part of his nonfiction output, I hope to encourage more interest in Ghanafani, not only as a novelist and a short story writer, but as a literary critic and political thinker. And, you know, this is a small means to try and encourage that, basically.
Well, Louis, that's a good way to wrap up. Can you tell us how we can get the book? Tell us how many copies we should each buy, one for display, one for reading, obviously.
Yeah.
And tell us what other schemes that Liberated Text is up to these days. What do you got going? What's exciting?
I mean, one thing I'll say about the book is that this has been done in full cooperation with the Ghanafani family. So they will receive royalties, obviously. And also a portion of those will go to the Ghassan Ghanafani Cultural Foundation, which is run by Annie and Layla, among others. And the foundation does absolutely incredible work in all the Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. It runs kindergartens, it runs art therapy sessions, art therapy centers, and does a lot of really amazing stuff that not only kind of honor his legacy, but I would say continue it, because he was renowned for loving children. And he even wrote a child's book for Lamis that has subsequently been published, called The Little Lantern. So yeah, I mean, you know, we intentionally priced the book as kind of cheap as possible, basically. So obviously, if you're able to please do buy a copy. It's essentially for sale, I think, almost on almost all booksellers now online. Probably the easiest way to see where you can buy it is go to the Ebb magazine website, and then there's links to all the places you can buy it from. So yeah, please do that if you can.
I'll link it in the description.
Yeah, cool. And the only other thing I wanted to make sure that I mentioned briefly is that, yeah, like I said, a few weeks ago, I was able to meet with Annie and Leila Kanafani in Beirut. So I presented them with copies of the translation, which they were extremely happy about, extremely grateful for. I can't, that meeting, to be honest, I could talk about that the whole other episode, but it was wonderful, and they're both brilliant. And it was very moving in a number of ways. And Annie Kanafani in particular, if people don't know, she's amazing because she's Danish by birth. She met Hassan in the 60s in Beirut. So when he was assassinated in 1972, she was in Beirut with two young kids. She very easily could have just left that life behind, basically, and gone back to Denmark and lived a very different, and I'm sure in many ways more kind of comfortable existence. But not only is she still in Beirut, although she has had periods of time in Denmark, but generally is in Beirut, established the foundation in his name and continues to run and be directly involved in it now. And she's at least in her mid-80s. She's just a really amazing and inspiring woman, as is Leila, very much kind of her father's daughter and doing him proud. So yeah, it's been a demanding but very rewarding project doing this. And yeah, you know, like I say, I view this as hopefully as encouraging a more holistic discussion and view of Kanafani in English, and just, you know, and just the beginning of that, rather than the end of anything, and just, you know, the start, hopefully, of different conversations and other things from here.
And what about Liberated Texts? What's up with the site? What's new? What's coming?
It's been a little bit of a hiatus this summer, partly because of this book, because it was, like I say, it was extremely time consuming. But there are several reviews coming in the autumn. And yeah, I mean, one thing again, which maybe I haven't said explicitly, is that this On Zionist Literature is the first in a kind of Liberated Texts series of books published in collaboration with Ebb Books. Not all of them will be translations. Some will be just republishing something that is either out of print or extremely expensive. I have the next one in mind and we're working on it, but I'm not ready to quite announce it yet. But there's good, exciting things to come.